All right, I'm calling the meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Today is Thursday, March 7th, 2024, and the time is 10:15. Today we are joined by Representative Armstrong, Representative Shragi, and myself, Chair Rauscher. And in the room, I don't see any legislators presently, but I would like to thank our House Record Secretary, Cale Brown, and our LIO moderator, Zach Lawhorn, and my committee aide, Craig Valdez, for all that they do for this committee. We are now joined by Representative Prox. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everybody, silence your cell phones. Those in the audience, same thing, if you would. Any personal electronics. And we'll also like to, any questions that need to go to those presenting, go through the chair, and any responses should go through the chair back to the representatives who asked them. Today's agenda is to hear testimony from Brandon. And Brandon, I'm going to, I hope I'm not going to trip over your name too bad, but I believe it's Spanos, and later on you'll be able to correct me, Acting Tax Director of the Department of Revenue regarding HB 368. Also regarding that bill is clean energy standards, clean energy transferable tax credits. I'm sorry, regarding that bill, which is clean energy standards and clean energy taxable tax credits. They will be speaking their fiscal notes and be answering any questions that they have from the committee. Following the Department of Revenue, we will hear from Daniel Heckman, Regulatory Manager for Golden Valley Electric Association, followed by Carrie Ann Baker, Director of Member Relations for Homer Electric Association, and finally Julie Esty, Chief Strategy Officer for Matanuska Electric Association. These are all regards to HB 368. So if you have your questions ready for them, that will be fine. We'll let them at least be able to have their presentation, and then you can ask the questions if you need. Mr. Spanos, if I have pronounced your name correctly, I appreciate you putting your name on record and giving us your affiliation. And if I have pronounced it incorrectly, please correct me. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Brandon Spanos, for the record, Acting Director for the Tax Division within the Department of Revenue. And here to introduce our fiscal note for HB 368, and it is an indeterminate fiscal note as far as costs and revenue, but we do have a little bit of an update that I'll share here as well.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure, absolutely.
Brief it is. All right, we are back on record. Please continue.
So the HB 368 would create a clean energy transferable tax credit that would be administered by the tax division. It would be used against electric, and the credit could be applied against or taken against the tax for electric and telephone cooperative taxes or any of the other 20-plus tax types that are administered within the Department of Revenue. The department would be required to issue a clean energy transferable tax credit certificate to a load servicing entity as defined under AS 4205790 for qualifying clean energy production that's produced under 4205910. The department would be would publish the name and the contact information for each person provided a certificate. The tax credit certificate could be sold, assigned, exchanged, conveyed, or otherwise transferred in whole or in part to a tax-paying entity to use against their tax obligations. Any portion not used by the taxpayer could be used at a later time, in a later tax period, or further transferred to another taxpayer. A clean energy transferable tax credit would need to be used within 5 years after being issued by the department. And the department would be required to split a certificate or the value of multiple certificates into specific denominations at the request of the holder of the certificate so they could utilize or transfer the various amounts. So if somebody had a $100 certificate and they wanted to split it into $250 certificates and sell them, they could do that, and we would issue those new ones. The department would also be required to combine multiple certificates into one certificate at the request of the holder of the certificate, and that would be in the case of a taxpayer buying multiple certificates from different entities and then wanting to utilize them in one tax return. The department would need to track the expiration dates of the original certificates and include those dates and amounts in the certificate that are split or combined. Splitting or combining the certificates would not change the extent or extend the period in which each credit that is included in that combined split or certificate must be used. So if there were two different certificates combined into one and they each had different expiration dates, the new certificate would show each period that those amounts would expire in. The bill grants the department authority to draft regulations to administer the transferable credit program. And as far as the revenue impact, when we created this bill, there was the less known. I'll read what I wrote in the fiscal note. The revenue impacts of the bill cannot be determined at this time due to the short time frame in order to create this fiscal note and the lack of knowledge that our department has about how much qualified clean energy would be produced, resulting in clean energy transferable tax credits. It's also impossible to know which tax programs those credits would be claimed against or which tax types would reduce whether it would be general fund or designated fund. This bill would have an indeterminate negative impact on overall tax revenue. Since we've drafted this, I'll speak to a little bit more to the revenue impact before I get into the implementation costs. Our main challenge in creating a precise fiscal estimate is figuring out how much new energy might be eligible for the credit. This would depend on specific projects, ownership, implementation dates, capacity, and how much of the project's capacity then translates into energy provided. Also, timing of claiming the credit, transferring, and then applying that against a tax return. So compiling a statewide list of and modeling would be a significant undertaking and also not in our area of expertise. Instead, in our next fiscal note, we'll update it to provide a simple example with some assumptions. The assumption is that 1% of the state's total energy production would be converted to qualifying projects each year, and the fiscal impact would be basically the first year would be $130,000 in credit, and then that would peak in year 10 at $1.3 million in credits. And these are credits generated, and the timing of reducing the taxes would be a bit of a lag because they would be applied against taxes in later years. And then back to our what I've written in the fiscal note would be implementation cost. So the cost and impacts of the bill couldn't be determined when I first drafted this. Looking at those numbers, I think it's more likely that we could do it with existing resources. But if those numbers were to climb and have larger numbers, the main administrative burden is transferring credits and being kind of like a broker for those that would be purchasing the credits. So the department has, we have administered a similar program in the past. So that was the GOM credit program. It created a significant administrative burden to issue, split, combine, track, transfer, reissue, and validate certificates that were claimed for use. The process at that time was done manually. We didn't have the current system that we have now, or at least this program wasn't in the system. The division would need to determine if it would, if there would be a cost, rather, we would need to determine if it would be cost efficient to utilize our tax revenue and management system to automate some of those processes. We would potentially consider utilizing electronic certificates rather than paper certificates, which we used in the past. And that could be more simple to track and then do that splitting, combining, and reissuing. The division would also explore utilizing a web interface for certificates to be applied for by those that qualify, and they folks could also request to transfer and combine and split the certificates through that web interface. And then that would obviously lighten the burden to administer the program by the division, and more time, we would need a bit more time to research the cost of that interface. There would likely be a cost to build out that interface and a module for the certificates, but likely we wouldn't need any additional personnel to administer it. That's all I've got.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Spanos. I was wondering if we, as a committee, were to there's some talk about the transmission line being built, and if the transmission line is to be built, there probably need a commission to look after the comings and goings of the electrons that run through it and how they correspond to the corresponding utility companies. Would we get a new fiscal note that would be quite kind of large for this bill if that was to happen?
I'm not sure I entirely, Mr. Chair, understand would there be additional credits because of how it's transmitted, or would there be a specific credit that would be applied in addition to the utilities generating a new source of energy?
Thank you. I was just wondering about tracking the happenings of that and the money that goes back and forth. I don't know. I just don't whether or not you guys would find yourselves needing to put in another fiscal note, or at this time you can't comment, and that's fine.
Yeah, it's probably safest for me, Mr. Chair, to say that I can't comment. I need to understand it a little bit better. If there were the things that would cost more for us to administer would be if the credits were much larger, there would be a lot more buying and selling, splitting and merging of credits. And that may require an additional person to be in charge of that. Also, when those credits are claimed, if they're used against multiple tax programs, there's a little bit more of an administrative burden. But if it's if we were to put this credit program into our system and build that web interface, that's a one-time cost, and the program could grow as large as it would need to, and it wouldn't cost any more to do that administrative piece. It would just be if it costs, or if there's more person hours that are needed.
I appreciate it. Does the committee members have any questions? No. Representative Prox is a question.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. A tax credit means that money that we thought might be available for something else won't be available because we just issued a credit. And I think it's fair to say that there was some buyer's remorse over the decision to issue tax credits for oil and gas exploration. Will the department come up with a order of magnitude impact to revenue anytime soon?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, as I mentioned earlier, our intent in our updated fiscal note will be to put an example in there. The example being if 1% of current power generation were converted to a tax credit, the example would be the credit would be $130,000 in year one.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
But yeah, those aren't looking at specific projects, though. That would be just kind of a general example. Mm-hmm. And then in year 10, the cost, or rather the revenue loss to the state through reduction in tax would be $1.3 million.
Okay, thank you.
Under that example.
Follow up?
Yes, Representative, this is the, we're not planning oil and gas in this bill.
I'm sorry?
We're not planning on putting any oil and gas in this bill.
No, I understand that. It's the tax credit. It's the same thing. It's a tax credit. And if we're just going to transfer 1%, that's $130,000. Maybe that's not a big deal. But this, I'm assuming that this whole standard is going to be more, much more than 1%. And then it starts to become a big deal. And we won't be able to talk about it 5-10 years from now. We're making a decision that is going to affect revenue in the same way that the oil and gas tax credits affected the income stream of the state. And I'm just thinking that needs to be into the conversation.
Yeah, Representative, appreciate the comment. And one of the things they do tax credits for is to encourage investment, encourage development, which brings people, which brings businesses, which brings jobs, which brings family. And in the long run, it kind of pays for itself. If not, it's more profitable for the state. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah.
So did you have another question?
Nope. For now, thank you.
All right. Anybody else have a question? All right. Well, we thank you very much. And we appreciate you taking the time to come here and give us your overview on our fiscal note and how it affects us. Thank you very much. Now, I guess we're going to go to Mr. Spanos. We're going to go to Mr. Hackman. If you can hear us, please put your name and affiliation on record, and you may begin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Daniel Heckman, and I am the regulatory manager for Golden Valley Electric Association. And I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify and share comments with you today. Before I continue, I would like to state just from the onset that Golden Valley's board of directors has not yet taken a position on HB 368 or a clean energy standard, and that I'm here representing Golden Valley from an operational and regulatory perspective and not necessarily a policy one. What I can share with you, though, is that Golden Valley's board previously released a statement concerning HB 317 or a renewable portfolio standard. And while Golden Valley supported the many broad goals of an RPS, such as reducing CO2 emissions, we took issue with the mandated measures that could impose costs to Golden Valley's members for significantly reduced reliability. We were concerned that as a rate-regulated electric cooperative, HB 307's mandates would affect the ability to recover costs of penalties that could not be imposed, that could be imposed, excuse me, for not meeting specific and prescriptive goals. We asserted that any proposed RPS legislation should promote collaboration across the rail belt with a state commitment, while also acknowledging the responsibilities of our respective utilities in accordance with our mission statements. I would like to note that HB 368 has addressed many of those concerns. And while I'm not here to endorse the bill one way or the other, not until our board has weighed in, I would like to highlight some positive improvements of note in HB 368. The legislation is not prescriptive as to a certain type of energy source. The cold weather recently experienced not only in South Central Alaska, but in Fairbanks, combined with the lack of natural gas in the Cook Inlet, the change in Golden Valley's cost of power adjustment that was recently filed with the RCA, and the recent modifications to our own strategic generation plan underscores the need for utilities to have a diverse generation portfolio. We are also encouraged to see that HB 368 utilizes an incentive-based mechanism in the form of renewable tax credits to achieve the legislation's goals rather than penalties that would ultimately harm our cooperative and member consumers. As this legislation has been recently introduced, we have not yet done a thorough analysis on the impacts the renewable tax credits may have on Golden Valley. And as iterated before, as our board has not yet weighed in, I'm not in a position to comment one way or the other. We believe that the dates contained in HB 368 are more achievable and realistic, and we are pleased that the legislation specifically recognizes that the build-out of an adequate transmission system is required, and that load-serving entities like Golden Valley should not be subject to the clean energy standard before the transmission lines are upgraded to the minimum standard required to ensure seamless end-to-end electrical energy transmission. In addressing HB 307, the board highlighted the federal funds that are being flowed through the state of Alaska via the Alaska Energy Authority. A recent $206.5 million grant award from the Department of Energy to reduce the transmission constraints between the Kenai and Anchorage areas requires an equal match by the state. And Golden Valley strongly encourages that this legislature provide that state match. This funding is just the first piece of what will help build out adequate transmission to allow the railroad electric utilities to share site-specific renewable resources. The ultimate end goal should be the ability of the railroad utilities to transmit the lowest cost power, irrespective of resource and wherever generated, to where it's needed the most, unconstrained. We would also like to note that recent legislation in the Senate has addressed the need for a railroad transmission organization to oversee and govern the railroad electric system, and we are supportive of that legislation. Consistent with other comments provided on separate pieces of legislation, we continue to maintain that any provisions as it pertains to net metering and net billing should be addressed in standalone legislation given the regulatory considerations involved. Golden Valley is actively continuing its efforts to decarbonize our power generation, regardless of any statewide mandate. We have demonstrated our commitment with past goals, and meeting the five prongs of our strategic generation plan is an utmost priority for Golden Valley. We undertake these tasks while maintaining our fiduciary obligations to our members. The recent modification Golden Valley made to its strategic generation plan ensures that as circumstances and conditions continue to change, we must have the flexibility to pursue all options and alternatives that are in the best interest of Golden Valley's members in lowering rates, increasing reliability, and reducing emissions, both in the short and long term. State policy and legislation should be the same. Golden Valley, thanks to the committee for the opportunity to share its views on HB 368 generally. We appreciate the committee's broad look at energy policy in Alaska this year, given the plethora of bills that are currently pending. From a Golden Valley perspective, our focus is on ensuring reliability, driving down costs, and improving emissions. We need to be flexible and look at the rail belt system as a whole. We appreciate that HB 368 seeks to make the focus on the rail belt in achieving meaningful and impactful change. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for hearing these comments today.
Thank you, Mr. Heckman. Before I turn this over to the committee for questions, I have one. You talked about net metering and net billing. You spoke on excluding and maybe in a separate bill that should be handled. I was wondering, can you speak a little bit more about why that position is a position that you guys see as relevant?
Mr. Chairman, from a Golden Valley perspective, in looking at other pieces of legislation that have addressed such as community energy facilities and net metering, we believe that there are broader regulatory considerations that need to be considered, just taking in operational aspects, regulatory aspects. That's consistent with what our board stated in the previous legislation, and we just believe that that approach should be taken as well with this legislation, that it should just be standalone legislation that looks at everything from a broader perspective.
I appreciate that. So, committee members, do you guys, regarding the bill, things that you want to know, how maybe the it affects Golden Valley in the bill, or if you have any questions, this would be an opportunity for you to ask them. Well, Mr. Heckman, you are off the hook, so appreciate it very much. And thank you very much for your testimony. Is there any more which you'd like to add before we let you go?
No, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And again, thank you for this committee's just dedicated focus to energy policy in Alaska this session. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you very much. Now, we will turn our attention to our next speaker, which is Ms. Baker. If you can hear us, please put your name and affiliation on record, and you may begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Rasher. Carrie Ann Baker, Chief Strategy Officer for Homer Electric Association. I just wanted to thank Chair Rauscher for the amount of time and effort that he's put into very important energy issues this session. Very much appreciate the thoughtfulness and the policies that are rolling out. We believe that House Bill 368 is a step in the right direction, considering what we were looking at in previous versions of the renewable portfolio standard. There's a lot to like about this bill. One of the things that Mr. Heckman spoke on very eloquently, so I'll just touch on it briefly, is the lack of penalties that are in this bill. One of the things that is really challenging for utilities is keeping the cost down. And as somebody who has been over collecting money from the utilities, I'll tell you, when you listen to your members cry because they can't pay their bills, you really think about things a little bit differently. When you hear about people who can't even come up with the money to extend the power line to their home to connect, some of these costs and some of the penalties, they don't seem quite as trivial or nominal to you when you've heard those stories. So I just want to thank you for removing that from this bill, because all of those costs would have been passed on to the members, and in some cases, those that are least able to afford it. So one of the things I think, maybe just big picture stepping back, is to understand what's happening in the market and how we got here. So HEA, for example, is predominantly reliant on a single fuel source in the Cook Inlet, which is Cook Inlet gas. We've attempted in the past to try and break up our contracts so that we could go and, you know, maybe get smaller amounts. And we still, there's only a single supplier. So if we had 5, 6, 7 suppliers out there, we might be having a different conversation. But from an energy security perspective, our board has been looking at that for quite a long time and started to make some plans about diversity. They felt, you know, if you wouldn't put all of your kids' college fund in a single fund, then we simply can't rely on a single fuel source or our members. We can't look our members in the eye and say, we got you the best deal. The reality is we got you the only deal there was. So the market is pushing HEA and all utilities to diversify. And that is going to happen, and it's been happening for quite some time. Right now, we're about 85% reliant on Cook Inlet gas, and the remainder of our generation, the roughly 15%, depending because it fluctuates, is hydro, some solar, and a mix of wind. One thing our board did is they realized that technology is changing so quickly. We, being HEA, had originally adopted a renewable portfolio standard goal for ourselves. And during the time period where that goal was on the books, we saw all sorts of technologies jump forward and backwards. So what our board did is they realized we probably shouldn't be naming and identifying certain things because this needs to be technology agnostic. Our goals are to produce reliable power at the lowest rate that is both fuel diverse and providing energy security. And so our board has actually adopted a policy that requires HEA to become fuel diverse and energy diverse. And so you'll see us talk a lot about that. You know, one thing, and I know several on the committee and the public is very interested in this, but one thing to really think about is transmission. And Mr. Heckman spoke on it, and I know Ms. Esty is going to speak on that at length in her presentation, so I'll try and keep my comments brief. But the ability to be able to freely transfer energy throughout the rail belt, currently we have just kind of a single extension line. It starts to cross the bay at South Kachemak, comes into the Homer Spit, goes all the way up to Fairbanks. But there's no redundancy. There's not a second way off the peninsula. And that just strikes us as something that would never be prudent if we were doing that today. The problem that we have as a state and as a utility is we're a very small population base. the rail belt consists of 80% of the population, and we come in at about 750,000 people. So when you talk about spreading the cost of transmission over a small population base, it's a pretty painful thing. You know, one of the things that we talked about before is, would a push for a policy success that results in such a drastic rate shock and could impact reliability, it may not be wise or measured approach that creates the energy security and diversification that we're looking for. From our perspective, we don't think our members care where the power is produced. Personally, they want the lights to turn on. They want the heat to turn on, and they want it to come from the lowest price source whatsoever. They don't necessarily care that, you know, Daniel and Golden Valley might have been the one to produce that electron. And I don't think that we should either. We should be able to freely transfer that throughout the organization so that we can get economies of scale and so that we can also buy power at the cheapest cost. So, you know, a bill like this is definitely a step in the right direction. We like that it doesn't have penalties. We do think that it probably should not come into effect until the transmission is deconstrained. And the reason I say that is because if it's rolled out and we are not able to freely transfer electrons, we're just going to have the same result, because what will happen is we'll all do independent type generation and we'll meet the standard, but it might not necessarily do it at the cost that you're thinking. So HEA would not support any sort of quota type system. We want any policy that is adopted to be focused on energy security, diversity, and we want it to be technology agnostic for a number of reasons. We need every tool. We need every tool on the table. And we just don't think people should be in the business of picking winners and losers. A free and open market that doesn't have physical constraint or other constraints that prevents me or any other utility or an IDP from going out and getting the lowest cost is something that we would struggle with. So we appreciate the time that's been put into this, and you know, in particular, this Representative Rauscher spent quite a bit of time learning our industry. And you can tell in the work that is coming out in the comments. So I really don't have a whole lot more to add other than I appreciate your time. I appreciate the time of my colleagues being here and speaking on it as well. And if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer that, any questions as well.
Well, I appreciate it, Ms. Baker. I appreciate you taking the time to come down and comment. And so I'm going to ask the committee, if they have any questions, please ask them while you have a utility company online here. And if there are no more questions, I will let you, Representative Prox does have a question.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I guess I want to pursue a little bit more the incentives and subsidy question. At the legislature level, we have to decide between funding schools and funding energy. And the two are a little bit interconnected in that if you reduce the cost of energy, you lower the cost of running a school. But at some point, we have to make a choice. And the incentives factor into this. Is your board looking at trying to keep the cost as apparent to your customers as you can, and rather than chasing after a subsidy?
Through the chair.
Through the chair.
Yeah, good.
Mm-hmm. I think what I hear your question to be is, are we in favor of the subsidies in this bill? And if so, would we be speaking about that to our members?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. To put an immediate example, we're considering matching a federal grant for the line between Homer and Beluga. And I think the state's share of that is $200 million ultimately. And we have to look at that. What is the benefit of doing that relative to how many school roofs could you repair for $200 million? And I don't know that people are understanding that we can only do one or the other with a given amount of money. And is that being discussed with the board and the members?
So, through the chair, Carrie Ann Baker, Homer Electric Association, I have not discussed the school budget with our members. I don't think that we would. We have discussed, but I will tell you, I am sitting right now in an office at the school volunteering today. So, it's a pretty important issue to me personally. That's probably, my internet may be a little spotty, but that's what I'm doing. So, I do, really, really appreciate the attention to the school issue, something that's personal to me. I hate the idea of our industries being pegged against each other like that because I care deeply about both of them. I really want strong, healthy schools for our kids and our communities. I'm pretty passionate about it. And all of my spare time goes to volunteering in schools. So I thank you so much for always bringing up their interests. It's challenging. It's a really challenging industry right now. And I don't envy any of you guys right now with this budget season where you're having to weigh priorities like how many roofs do we put on or do we invest in transmission? It's pretty complicated. We have had discussions with our board and internally about being financially responsible, about the pressures that all of you are facing because you have a limited amount of funds and how are you going to spend them. And this transmission bill is one of those priorities that you're going to have to consider and weigh what it is. So we're talking about it. I mean, Homer Electric recently, for the first time in several years, had to do a base rate increase of 3.5%, and we agonized over it. We know that our members were hurting. We knew that COPA was going up at the same time, but our inflation rate over the several years since we hadn't raised rates had gone up 19%. Mm-hmm. And we did what we could to cut everything we could to limit it and hold that rate increase to 3.5%. But it weighs heavy on us. We're not talking specifically about the school budget, but every one of the members of my board are very big supporters of schools and communities. We're community oriented as cooperatives, and that is being felt. For us, we're here to talk about what our needs are and what we see as the future and how energy security is going to be needed. And then, fortunately, I guess for the presenters, it then comes to all of you in that room to make the decision on how that's divvied up, and it's not an easy one. But I appreciate the diligence with which you're approaching it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. Representative Schrage has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher, and through the chair. First off, thank you so much for volunteering in your local school today. That's so great to see, and just really appreciate it because our schools really do need every little bit of help that we can give them right now, and that includes parents volunteering, and just so thank you for your role in that. I think the Representative Prox brings up some interesting questions. I think it's a little unfair, though, to have you answer questions it's really our job to figure out how to prioritize the funds that the state has, and I think we could just as easily, ask you, should we pay dividends instead of investing in energy, or pay dividends instead of investing in education? I mean, all of these are expenditures for the state that we have to balance, and I think that's more of a question for us at the dais here than for you. But specific to things that you should be weighing in on, I think, or something that you can maybe speak to that would be helpful to me, is you talked about the difficulty of raising rates, and I know that it does have a real impact on people's lives. One of the things I grapple with today, thinking about energy issues, is, those rate increases are coming no matter what we do, thanks to the natural gas situation that we have. And I know that you're going to be hearing about very difficult conversations that are happening with your customers over this issue as their rates climb. And I think, hindsight's always 20/20. Some of us looking back go, geez, it would have been so helpful to customers if we had raised rates a little bit a while back so that we could have invested more in renewables so that we would be less prone to the vulnerabilities to natural gas prices that we have now. But I've heard from utilities that in many cases, even if they want to make those investments, they haven't been able to because they knew that if they went to the RCA, they would get denied because when you look at your avoided cost, it's cheaper at current, it was cheaper at current natural gas prices to just continue with the status quo instead of investing in renewables. And so I'm just curious, is that a problem that Homer Electric has run into in your internal discussions of, geez, we would have liked to have invested in renewables knowing that they're a little bit higher cost, but that there's a benefit to the diversification, but that you would have been turned down at the RCA level because it didn't pencil out as smart when it comes to rates in the immediate term. Does that make sense?
To the chair, Ms. Baker.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, Carrie Ann Baker, Homer Electric Association. The question that was asked was, would utilities be prevented from diversifying by incorporating different fuel sources for generation if it was higher than natural gas? And we would have been. So that is an issue. You know, the thing that's happening right now through the chair is that really these projects are coming in competitive at this point. The numbers that we're seeing, and we've been working with a group for a long period of time, as a large solar group. They're very savvy. They're very astute. They know what they're doing. We got all the way to where we were getting ready to start talking about a PPA, and the land that they were going to build their project on got pulled out from under them. So that's a scenario where everybody wanted it. The cost was competitive with our existing COPA. We were thrilled. They were thrilled. And then at the last second, some of the neighboring groups didn't want the project there. So they've moved on, but it's cost us a year. But those numbers are coming in competitive. And I think you're going to see a lot more competition, and you're going to see competitive pricing from all sorts of things, from renewables, from clean energy sources. Our industry is changing so quickly on this issue that these groups are competitive. You know, some other challenges that weren't addressed, but I do think that you may be interested in hearing about is a lot of times you'll get somebody that has a dream of producing whatever it is, some type of energy. And they'll go in and they'll get the leases on state land, and then the site's tied up, and they don't have the capability to produce the project. And so a lot of us will be standing back, waiting, knowing we could do the project, but there's somebody site camping on the area. Now, if they own it, that's their business. They can do what they want. But that is something that this committee should really consider looking into is, how long does somebody get to hold on to leases that they aren't producing that other people could then come in and actually take that on a little bit more? Because these numbers are competitive and they are coming in competitive now. And so will they every time? No. But if there's such a big difference, somebody else will come in and they'll start doing it in a competitive way. And that's, I mean, I'm sure Mr. Heckman and Ms. Essie can speak to that, but the numbers that we're seeing, frankly, have us kind of excited.
Representative, follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. Follow-up on a slightly different topic. So, but related, you said that these projects are coming in cost-competitive now. Do you have the liquidity to invest in everything that you want to invest in right now? I think the tax incentives are a great idea. I think creative in providing a carrot instead of a stick, but that's money that comes after you've made those investments. Does that do what you need, or do you need money really more up front to be able to make the necessary investments in renewables? Can you speak to that at all?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, Carrie Ann Baker, Homer Electric Association. It depends. Each utility is going to give you a little bit different answer. Right now, our margins are a little bit thinner than we would like them because of the investment that we've made in our battery energy storage system. We'd still do it again, but it was an investment. We're cash positive and we're in a healthy position, but our margins are thinner than we would like them to be. We tend to be fairly conservative at HEA and like a larger margin. So the short answer is, do we have money to do every single thing we want? No. Do we have enough to proceed down the path on the projects that we're pursuing as a group with the other utilities or with independent power producers? We're feeling pretty good at that. We've been very competitive, and because we're a small rural utility, we were able to qualify for some of the PACE and New Era things that have made our situation in regards to clean energy and diversification better than I think some others. And I think it really depends on the project. If you're talking about a large hydro project like the Sitna-Wantana, something like that, no, that's not something that we could take on. And we would want to, if we were, we'd want to do it as a with our other fellow utilities in the state, something that large. But the ones that we're looking at, they're competitive. Other people, IPPs are investing in them. We're investing in some. But we've been looking at this for a really long time. So that's kind of where we are. I hope that was an adequate answer.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. If there are no more questions, we're going to move on to talk to Ms. Esty. If you want to stay online, Ms. Baker, it would be good because they may have more questions later after we visit with Ms. Esty from MEA. Can you hear us, Ms. Esty?
I can hear you, Chairman Rauscher. Can you hear me?
I certainly can. So if you want, and you will, please put your name on record and begin your testimony. Give us your affiliation and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Rauscher. My name is Julie Esty. I'm with Matanuska Electric Association and serve as their Chief Strategy Officer. Just want to echo Ms. Baker and Mr. Heckman's appreciation of the work that this committee's done. The list of presentations and expertise and bills that you've had before you have been impressive, and I really appreciate your commitment to educating yourselves and having public debate for public consideration in this really important energy conversation. Specifically, Chairman Rauscher, you and your staff with Craig have done extensive work on this topic, and we really appreciate your efforts on it. MEA is the longest standing and second largest electric cooperative in Alaska. We serve a service territory the size of West Virginia that extends from south in Eagle River, north to south Denali State Park, and over to Glacier View. So it's a pretty large and diverse group of not only members, but also kinds of services, everything from large residential load, but also homes and businesses, both remote and more urban. As you've heard throughout these presentations over the last few months, Alaska is at a critical point in our energy future. There's scarcity in gas, making our old ways of producing power expensive at best. There's new innovative power options, either here or on the horizon, from nuclear to energy storage to new ways of making our old generation, like coal and gas, cleaner. There are more options than ever. Renewables, as Ms. Baker alluded to, which have not necessarily been economic or competitive in the past, are now able to compete with our projected fuel costs into the future. And MEA has one solar project online now that currently beats our avoided cost. So as Ms. Baker said, times are definitely shifting. And there's federal funding, and whether you agree with it or not, it's available to cut our costs in half for making some pretty significant generation-changing impacts to our grid. And also, our members are asking us to be more innovative on our energy solutions. MEA surveys our members every year, and every year we ask the question, do you want us to be producing more power with renewables? Consistently, it's between 60 and 70% say yes. The kicker with that is then we ask, well, what if it's going to cost a little bit more? And then the answer, of course, always drops to no. So our members are clearly sensitive to cost as looking at our future energy options. And I think most exciting that we have a governor and a legislature that are invested and motivated in making changes to our, to help us make changes to this energy pathway to allow Alaska to grow. This moment requires some bold and visionary leadership from elected officials, both government elected officials as well as utility boards. You all are the ones that Alaskans have entrusted with these decisions. And this is a moment in history where we'll be judged both on what we did and also probably what we didn't do. There's many options on the table, as I discussed, to allow Alaska's future to catapult the state to a new place. But they all have trade-offs. They all have supporters and detractors, and the reality that likely a few will win out. They need to. We need to move forward. MEA is actively working on with our fellow colleagues at other utilities as well as other stakeholders on a solution, from the gas working group to our own investigations, collaborations with other utilities, our participation in the Rail Belt Reliability Council, which will do joint integrated resource planning. It's going to take a team. Individual utilities can't and shouldn't do this alone. Gone is the luxury of us thinking about our own ratepayers. We are now accountable to the system, the region, and the rest of the state. MEA supports joint planning and the inclusion of external stakeholder perspectives in that process. We appreciate the governor's leadership in forming the Energy Security Task Force. Tony Izzo, MEA CEO and my boss, was the Rail Belt Utility Representative on the task force and served as the Rail Belt Subcommittee's co-chair along with Jen Miller with Renewable IPP. After dozens of meetings, presentations, public process, and considerable discussions, the group unanimously came together around three main strategies. The first was transmission unification. As both Mr. Heckman and Ms. Baker alluded to, transmission, creating a single backbone managed and built for the public good, is critical for us to move forward. MEA believes this is the single most important step we can take for our energy future, no matter what kind of electron you favor. We appreciate the leadership of both the governor and the Senate Resources Committee for crafting legislation to begin the discussion on that. The second was growing load. Now, this helps spread the same fixed costs over more kilowatt hours, so reduces the cost for all. Things like industrial loads, growth in the number of homes and businesses, or beneficial electrification like electric vehicles, heat pumps, and other ideas are all in that category. MEA is fortunate to have probably one of the only growing loads, on, at least on the rail belt system, due to the growth in Eagle River in the valley. We're thankful for that growth and hope it continues, but we also acknowledge it comes as a cost to infrastructure. As we upgrade the system to account for that growth, that shouldn't be overlooked. The third and final large strategy that the committee came up with was to diversify generation. And that is for energy security, resilience, and to remain cost competitive. And the very first action listed on that strategy was to develop a clean energy standard with incentives. And that was the consensus of the entire committee and ratified by the larger the security task force. And that recommendation was based on input from NREL that said specifically for cooperatives, at least, penalties are just going to be passed directly to consumers. And so the concept of incentives, an incentive-based clean energy standard, was born so that it can be a catalyst for diversification. Now, Representative Rauscher, I know you spent significant amount of time around that table in those discussions, and we really appreciate both yours and Senator Bishop's time on that task force. We know it was a lot of time during your interim. And we also appreciate your leadership in crafting a bill that specifically focuses on this recommendation to create a clean energy standard with incentives. The MEA board has established our goal of our own. We have a 50% clean energy by 2050 goal. We view this as a realistic goal, but also an aspirational stretch due to the limitations of our existing electric system, rate-making realities, the current regulatory and permitting environment, a harsh environment, and also lessons learned from countries and states who did move too fast, too soon, without fully understanding the unintended consequences. We appreciate that Senate Bill 386 aligns not exactly, but closely to those targets. As we read through the bill, there are several components that MEA appreciates about this bill. First, reachable, attainable goals. MEA is supportive of a clean energy standard with incentives that can be a catalyst for change and not set up to fail. Many states and countries have come before us on this, and we have lessons to learn from them. Many have started with modest goals, built trust, built the systems, and then were able to and gained lessons learned, and then were able to add to those goals if it made sense. You've heard testimony in your committee that many states had some sort of RPS, CES, or carbon reduction goal. And as we look through those, many, that's accurate, many do have those goals. Many are less than the goals that you've seen before you in other bills and in this bills. And granted, some are more. But there is a wide range, and we think attainable yet aspirational goals are important, and we think this bill reaches those. We also appreciate the acknowledgement of the key role that transmission plays. I think both Mr. Heckman, Ms. Baker, and myself have all spoken to that. Our constrained system is a limiting factor. Now, we can make significant progress with our limited system, but we can lower the costs and risks of that progress to our members through economies of scale and sharing projects between utilities. Transmission improvements are necessary to achieve those big goals without incurring costs or relying on unproven technology to achieve them. We also like the provisions to count progress and waive requirements if there is progress being made, but maybe just not quite reaching the goal yet. Some of the best projects experience delays. Even our Hawk Lane solar project with renewable IPP, we had everybody on board for that project. We had the borough excited about it, the renewable IPP, the utility was in favor, the local landowners, all willing participants, and a great contract that was approved from the RCA. But world events impacted financing, supply chain issues, and slowed down progress. So can it be done faster? Absolutely. Is the next project going to experience those same things? Gosh, I hope not. But we appreciate that there are provisions that will allow for utility members to be held harmless for things outside of our control, or if the project has maybe reached specific milestones but not quite crossed that finish line yet. We also appreciate that it allows for a calculation for net metering energy. The way that net metering currently exists now is the utility doesn't necessarily see all that's produced. We only see what crosses our meter and back onto the system. But there is this bill gives an acknowledgement that the that net metering is offsetting a huge amount of natural gas generation or other generation that we may not see crossing the meter. This allows for a proxy. It's something that's we've seen in other states and their policies, and we really agree with it. It allows the RCA to create a proxy number, allowing for a capacity factor calculation so that we can assume some of those calculations and truly count what our members are offsetting and providing to our generation portfolio. It allows us to better really track that true benefit. We like that it allows for energy efficiency. The key really that we're all getting to is to offset fuel and help it extend farther into the future. And the cheapest fuel is a fuel we don't actually have to use. So energy conservation efforts, both from our members on the demand side, but also things that we can do, burning less fuel for the power we create on the supply side, on the generation side, should be something that utilities are motivated to keep reinforcing. And so there can be real progress made to those goals. There are many states that have allowed that to be part of their standards, and they're seeing results. In fact, in Vermont, there's a company called Vermont Energy Investment Corporation, and they actually bid in like they're a generator, but actually what they're doing is they're just taking, say, 5 megawatts as they're taking that off the load of the system in conservation. So there's some real efforts that are resulting in real results that we hope that can be a part of our energy solutions. We like that it reinforces collaboration. We've took some big steps forward in joint planning among the utilities, and we really like that this bill reinforces the utilities to work together to achieve the goals instead of having small myopic decision making. Speaking to the incentives, there's been a little bit of conversation about that. We think that tax credits are a creative way to incentivize change and help with the economics. And it's great to see them in this bill. And to Representative Prox's question, they are fairly modest, and their focus on the economics likely won't change based on these. They may not be a deal maker, but they are helpful to our members. And because it exists through the cost of power, that goes directly to our members for a benefit. So we are interested in the incentives and appreciate the committee looking at that as a creative solution. Also, the net billing concept is interesting to us. It provides a mechanism for the RCA to vary the rates paid back to members based on how helpful that power is to the system and to the rest of the members at any given time. For MEA, it doesn't necessarily help us or our diversification goals if we motivate our members to push a whole bunch of power, say, on a sunny summer day when we don't really need that power in the system. Instead, we'd rather incentivize them to invest, say, in maybe a battery system, and then the power can come back to the system when it's more helpful. And that decreases costs for the entire membership. So we really appreciate those items in the bill. Things we think are worth maybe another look. First is the opt-out provision. We're not sure that this is necessary, as there's already adequate provisions for waivers, and also because it's incentive-based and no penalties. However, if you do decide to keep it in the legislation, we propose allowing for those long-term effects to include reliability as well as rates. The second is the transmission description. There, as I mentioned before, there are two bills going through in the Senate right now. Senate Bill 257 specifically, that really focuses on the transmission backbone, and we would support language that would align this language of this transmission backbone to that of 257. And I also think in here you could probably eliminate the reference to the road belt transmission system. While we'd love some sort of motivation to keep that project going, it may not be necessary in this legislation. And then, of course, the question I keep getting asked is, coal, does it need to be in here? And we do admit it's a creative solution in a clean energy standard. But also, I think acknowledging that these are crazy times. And mind, mouth, coal, as MEA looks at our options to fill the gap, especially in the short term on April 1st when our gas contracts go away. Mind, mouth, coal has a lower environmental footprint, likely, than importing LNG. Likely at a lower cost, lower risk, and it keeps money in the Alaskan economy. And I'm not saying that to pick sides. There's room for both in our energy portfolio. But we appreciate the acknowledgement in this bill that it's at a dynamic time, and it's not really the best time to pick and say this technology is good and this technology is bad. We appreciate that acknowledgement that all options need to be on the table. So MEA is not opposed to it being in there. That being said, this bill includes no mandate to use coal. And if our board did decide to include coal in our diversification plan, we do believe we could adequately account for it in the non-designated percentage of generation not covered by the clean energy standard. We have other small nitpicks of language that we'll share with staff, not worthy of taking up more time here. But the other question I want to address is a question I kept getting asked as I've been in the Capitol over the last few months is it necessary? And I think to Carrie Ann's point, luckily for us, that's up to you all sitting around the table and your colleagues in the building based on what role you think the government should play in the energy transition. And in some ways, it solves an old problem, right? I mean, up until a year ago, clean energy was a nice to have. And there were some people that thought that the utilities were not moving fast enough and they wanted us to move faster. Fair enough. But with the wake-up call we received from Hillcorp, our primary gas supplier, a year ago, it really changed things and shifted the dynamics. It really brought true market forces to play to solve the problem and to move the needle. So now we have scarcity and price sensitivity introduced into our fought. And we agree with Carrie Ann and also with Chris Rose when they say that alternative forms of energy, including renewables and other clean energy, can now compete with traditional fossil fuels, especially at projected fuel prices. MEA believes traditional market forces like economics and the free market will naturally drive a more diverse energy portfolio. That being said, we also understand that there's benefit in the legislature and the governor setting a standard to give clear direction, certainty, and market signals to the broader market. It could provide clear direction to the RCA and to the co-op boards to make bold moves towards a common vision. We believe that this CS, with just a few adjustments, is the best option on the table for common sense energy standard that's both pragmatic and aspirational and can act as a true catalyst for energy transition to diversification and stabilize costs. Finally, I can't let any opportunity go by without saying really for the utilities, reliability is key. And keeping the lights on is essential to all of us. MEA cannot support any legislation that jeopardizes our certificated responsibility and that commitment to our members. We believe this bill takes all of that into account and has a true appreciation of the realities that we're facing, but also pushes us towards a new transition. In the end, it's really up to us, both our members and our board elected, our member elected boards, and the constituents elected, to solve these complex problems. Other voices are critical to the process in developing those solutions, but it'll be our board members and you all sitting around those seats that will be accountable for the success and the failure. MEA really appreciates being brought to the table to be part of the solutions, and we're happy to be a resource and available to answer any questions. We really appreciate the opportunity to provide comments and also the opportunity that putting this kind of legislation provides to the greater public as far as the costs and benefits of how we want to move forward in this critical juncture. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Estee. Do any of the committee members have any questions? I would like to make a statement. We've heard the word or the bill RPS mentioned a few times today. And I really want to thank Senator Tobin and and Representative Sumner, because I believe that sparked an argument, whether for or against, very lively and very spirited on both ends of how it was viewed for those. And it also it got the discussion going, which led to where we're now. And I think that was a very important step. So I don't think that all is lost whenever you write a piece of legislation that doesn't move in the beginning. There's always things that could happen for it. So any questions now for Ms. Estee? She and the rest of the panel are still available. And if there aren't any, I want to invite these testifiers to offer changes. Okay, if you guys and gals find a reason to signify something in the bill that needs a change, or let us know what may work a little better, work a little worse, we're willing to hear it. This committee is about improving. This committee is about getting it right, but also being expedient about getting it completed this year. So I just would like to offer that opportunity to the three of you who testified today. You're more than welcome to offer us comments and corrections. And Representative Prox, you have a question.
Thank you, Chair Rusher. I would just like to kind of add to that, that we do want to make a decision this year, and you can't just debating aspirational theories or theories in general. And it would be great for the people that are involved in this to focus on the bill that is in front of us and what are we going to do about that bill. So thank you for bringing that up.
Appreciate it. And I do thank those that were testifying that gave credit to the Governor's Task Force. I'd like to give some credit to APA and the members. All of which are, there's three right here on the screen. But I also want to give the governor some credit. I want to give there's a lot of credit to go around for trying to make this, whether it's REAP. REAP had a good part to play in making this legislation. It was not one-sided, and it didn't all come from one office. There was a lot of people that were that chimed in, Usability Cole. There were others. So I just want to say this was a lot of work went into this and a lot of listening to everyone. Representative Schrage, you had a comment.
Yeah, thank you. It's not directly related to this bill, but because transmission plays such a role, I think, in setting the course for energy policy and what we're able to realistically do on the grid, I was curious. I think some of the proposals I've seen out there with respect to the GRIP and other I know we're only on the first phase of our grant applications for improving transmission in the state. And I think some of the proposals I've seen have been to fund the GRIP at a pretty low level, maybe $30, $40 million or so, as opposed to the full $200 in match that would be required to fully realize those federal funds on the front end. Julie, do you have any thoughts, Ms. Etsy, do you have any thoughts on whether or not that's adequate and whether or not a failure to invest in these projects hinders your ability to best serve your customers?
Thank you, Representative Schrage, through the chair. I appreciate the question. As I said, transmission is definitely our number one priority here, and I think we have that once-in-a-generation opportunity as Alaskans. I mean, as we are stymied in what we can invest in because we have so few members covering the costs, and because I mean, especially for MEA, 75% of our members of our load is residential, and our membership is residential. And so these are, you know, these are homes and small businesses primarily in our service territory that would be carrying that load. So we have exactly the transmission system that we can afford right now. The federal funding represents just a unique opportunity for us to be able to gain this transmission system that can then provide so many significant cost savings and so much energy security and so much energy diversity to the state that could drive economic development, but really just help us solve some big problems that are presenting themselves. So I can't say enough how critical investment in this system is. And again, the federal government has shown, they gave us the fifth largest award in the country. And we just submitted for the second phase, which brings that line up to Fairbanks, and that they accepted our concept paper and invited us to submit an application. So they're still showing us that they are willing to support Alaska's drive to have this grid that really, I mean, we're not asking for much. This is really just bringing our grid up to lower 48 standards, right? I do think they are making this decision whether we will receive the second tranche of funding right when the legislature will hopefully for you guys gavel out and final budget decisions will be made. I do think making sure Alaska shows that we are equally as invested in the success of our state as the federal government should be is going to be critical. I understand, you know, we just had the conversation led by with Representative Prox and Ms. Baker, that, you know, you guys have a lot of tough decisions. So, you know, I don't think that I can stand here and say this must be prioritized over all. But I can say that, you know, these costs, lowering costs of electricity really allows you to lower or to let your dollars stretch farther from education to all the other things that you guys invest in, that lowering those energy costs helps throughout the state. So, I do think it is important to send a signal there, but I also understand the realities that you guys have. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Representative Schrage, I'll follow up.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe just as I sense the committee is prepared to close out for the day, just maybe a thought. The reason I asked is, you know, I think going back to Representative Prox's question about, you know, priorities, and I think that's a decision for us as we look at the budget this year and the policy that's before us. And, you know, I just think that, well, for all the reasons you just stated, from helping with it being a once in a lifetime opportunity, being able to leverage federal dollars, really be a boon to energy security, reliability, to promoting business development. I think there's so many benefits of that come with making these investments. And just as we look at how to prioritize things, it seems that while the dividend is very helpful, it seems that some of these investments would also pay dividends for a lifetime in terms of, again, energy security and the benefits that come with that. So just a thought. We've got some difficult decisions ahead of us.
Thank you, Representative Shragi. So any more comments or questions from the committee members? Well, and I do want to apologize to Mr. Heckman for having to go first. We go from committee to committee to committee, and sometimes it takes a person or two to be speaking before our minds start to generate in one direction, and that's why all the questions came later than in the beginning. So, but we do appreciate all three of you for being here. And so if there are no other comments that anybody has here, there is no more business before the committee today, and I'm going to adjourn at 11:31.